This week we are going to begin a series of three sermons reflecting on the Great War and what it means for us today as Christians. I hope that this time of reflection will give us an opportunity to better understand what these events mean for us today as citizens, but more importantly, as people of faith. Now, as we delve into this, a quote came to mind. Some of you may remember Zhao Enlai, Mao's foreign secretary. He famously observed, when asked about the meaning of the French Revolution, that it's too soon to tell. I should offer a disclaimer here. I'm going to feel a little bit like Snopes, the website that debunks urban myths. There is a possibility that Zhao was actually referring to the student riots in Paris of 1968, which strips his observation of some of its great cosmic insight. It's one thing to talk about events from 200 years ago being indecipherable, another to talk about something that had transpired a few years earlier. But I think the quote is still illuminating for us because of what it suggests about the French Revolution. That was one of those events in human history that was so great and so seismic, its implications so tremendous, that people understood the notion that even 200 years later, it would still be hard to discern its ultimate meaning and influence on human civilization. The Great War is another such event. And this year we mark its centenary. If you've been in a bookstore lately in the last few months, you'll have noticed that there's been a flood of titles about the war. And there have been TV shows and documentaries. To this day, people are still trying to figure out what the war meant, why it happened, what it signifies for us. In that sense, perhaps it is too early for us to say what it means. But maybe not. We do know that World War I did indeed change everything. It was one of those inflection points when we can look at what happened before and after and see that everything headed in a new direction. The world we live in today is a world that was formed by this conflict. All you need to do is open your newspaper, click open a web browser, watch the TV news. You hear talk of Islamic State and its desire to reestablish the caliphate. Trace that back to the fall of the Ottoman Empire. We see that there's fighting going on about borders in the Middle East, Africa. That goes back to World War I. Putin's Russia, resurfacing notions of an imperial Russia. That goes back to World War I. The list goes on. We live in a world shaped by this conflict. And this is true for politics and culture. And yes, religion. Islam and Judaism and Christianity were all profoundly affected by this war. Consider Islam. The Ottoman Empire sided with the Central Powers. It lost. The ramifications of this were seismic. Consider. The Ottomans had been the caliphate. This was a concept from political theology in the Islamic world that dated back to Muhammad. There was a temporal power that traced its roots all the way back to the emergence of Islam. And in different forms and iterations and in different empires and with different dynasties, it was passed down from generation to generation. But after the war, when Kemal Ataturk and his colleagues in the Young Turk movement staged a revolution and decided that their country had to westernize and be secularized, if it was not to endure such a fate again, the caliphate was abolished. The caliphate that Islamic State seeks to reestablish today is the same one. They are drawing on ancient concepts, reacting to events of long ago. And they're doing so with horrible and bloody and barbaric results. We look at the lines of borders drawn for countries in the Middle East today, cutting through religious groups and nationalities. This is a result of the British and the French taking control of the Ottoman Empire and its territories after the war. We live with those consequences. The implications for the Jewish people were also marked in both good ways and bad. It was in November 1917 that A.J. Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, issued his famous declaration calling for the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in the Holy Land. It was this event that made the Zionist dream possible. And then just a month later, Lord Allenby led British troops into Jerusalem. He didn't ride in on a horse or in a tank. He walked in to show his respect for this holy city. General Allenby was a shrewd political operator. He knew that he wanted to respect the sensitivities of people. He wasn't interested in any kind of messianic statement. But that did not stop people throughout the Christian world from looking at the entrance into Jerusalem in just those terms. A new age was dawning. It was emerging. It wasn't just the Jews who took hope from the British conquest of the Holy Land. Christians did too. Finally, after 1,300 years, with the exception of the 200-year interregnum of the Crusaders, Christians would be in possession of the Holy Land again. People looked at the war through religious lenses. European civilization was steeped in religion in ways we can't imagine today, even for people who may not have gone to church. They understood things using the language of Christianity and of that perspective. And so people, whether of high estate or low, whether they were in the military or politics, civilians, people looked at the world through the lens of Christianity. They brought their faith with them to war in song and in word and in art. The churches were as enthusiastic about war in 1914 as any other institution in society. Whether it was the Lutheran Church in Germany, or the Church of England and the British Empire, indeed the Catholic Church in avowedly secular France, all endorsed their governments and war aims. Even here in the United States, where we didn't have a national church, preachers and ministers were fully on board. You take a look at most UCC ministers today, you'll find a lot of them, I should say, not most, but many, are what might be called raging peaceniks, against war in any situation. Well, it's a bit of a change from our congregational forebears back in 1914, where people in pulpits were calling for holy war against the Hun. Holy war. And it's not a notion that arose out of nowhere. We heard verses from Deuteronomy today that talk about having God's blessing through the priests before the armies of Israel went off to war. But something happens along the way from Deuteronomy to the breaking out of the Great War. National churches found themselves suborned to and compromised by relationships with the state. Oftentimes setting aside God's call to that of the government. Christianity was profoundly affected by this war. Consider what happens in Russia. The Orthodox Church was spiritually alive and vibrant in 1914. We know what happened in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution in late 1917. The communists could not abide any alternative sources of power, and so they struck out and destroyed the Orthodox Church. It was cataclysmic. The impact in the West was also remarkable. In Germany, where people believed that the war was something blessed by God, that it was a sacred and holy activity, people wondered, if this was so, how was it possible that Imperial Germany lost the war? If God was on side, how could this happen? You may recall from your history lessons that very quickly after the conflict ended, the notion of the stab in the back arose. Germany didn't lose the war. They were cheated. Bankers, communists, and Jews undermined the war effort. We know where that thinking led. The church adopted it, just as political elites did. The state was betrayed, and so was Jesus. And the church in Germany, most of it, there were a few segments that did not go along, but most of it began a journey down a road that led to complicity in World War II and crimes 20, 25 years earlier had not yet been conceived or imagined. More encouraging, there was also an earthquake in religious thinking. People like Karl Barth and Paul Tillich, Rudolf Otto, began to talk about God in new ways, pointing out that perhaps humanity, with its confidence in the Enlightenment and reason, could not fully apprehend the power of God, and perhaps should not be placing itself on the same level as a creator. Their thought revolutionized Christian thinking. Now, we might wonder, if all of this happened then, why does it matter for us now? What do we make of it? What are we to do with this as people of faith? Well, as I mentioned earlier, there has been a spate of books coming out about this war. One is a very popular best-selling book by a European academic named Christopher Clark, and it's called Sleepwalkers. And the title of this book essentially encapsulates the thesis of his argument that Europe sleptwalked into war, that everybody was ultimately culpable and to be blamed. And this theory builds on earlier ones like Barbara Tuchman's put forward in The Guns of August, that all the powers were locked into mobilization tables. And once the First Army began to mobilize, the Second had to follow. Great forces drove this along. The war happened to people. But there's another school of thought. It's probably best exemplified by Max Hastings in his book, Catastrophe 1914, which says and argues that Germany was at fault. And he points out that making this case isn't some effort to say my side, the British, are better than your side, the Germans. But he notes that to understand history, we have to talk about it honestly, to essentially name names. And that Germany had political aims that it sought to pursue through military means. That actions have consequences. And as we consider these schools of thought, we should reflect on what our faith tells us about how the world works. Because we don't participate in a faith tradition that says that there are unnamed forces out there doing stuff to us. We have a faith that's very personalized. We talk about God coming to us in the person of Jesus, who makes a difference in all of history through his life and his death and his resurrection. And we talk about people like Peter and Paul who choose to be disciples, who make choices and follow through on them. Individuals matter. The choices they make shape institutions and what they do. And we need to know this and recognize this. If we are going to live into the gospel call to promote the good and to identify and resist evil. And the need to do that is as great today as it has ever been before. So as we think about the Great War and how it has shaped the church, we can think about how it will shape the church going forward, how it might shape us and our faith. And my hope and my prayer is that we won't focus so much on the fighting of holy war, as we will on the living of holy lives.